I'm going to give you a little different view than you might have seen on TV recently of the program. But most people are aware that the flags across the bottom there are, in fact, the multinational partnership that's part of F-35. The flags on the top are what we call partner countries, partner nations, officially joining the program back in the 2002 timeframe. Australia was actually the last country to join the group, almost a year to the day after we received our go-ahead contract. So if you can imagine, we got a contract on October 26, 2001. We had about 150 people on the program in one country, that was the UK. At the end of 2002, we had about 4,000 people on the program just in Fort Worth, and we picked up seven additional countries, all of which by agreement would have industrial participation on the project. So when we talk about a complex program, the startup was probably one of the more complex phases of the program. Let me kind of walk you through some of the how this whole thing really started. Why is there a JSF? This chart shows you the number of airplanes procured, number of fighters procured annually by the United States. And you can see back in the 75 to 90 time frame, they were bought in large quantities. And in fact, there was a large number of programs. Most of our international partners today fly these three airplanes right here, and they bought them at about that point in time. Okay, so once the procurement holiday, as it's referred to, started and coming down off of the first Gulf War, the average age of the fighter fleet, you can see, started advancing pretty rapidly. Went from about 9 to 10 years on average back in the 80s and 90s to today, we're about 23 years on average with our multi-role fighter force. And most of our international partners are in the same situation. Another interesting thing you can see about by this graphic is you see the F-35 in the right there. That's replacing basically the pile on the left. So you can get a good idea of what the force structure reductions have been over the course of time. I think every nation today flies a smaller Air Force than they flew probably 20 years ago. So we had this was the first issue. There was a requirement to replace the aging fleet. The second one was this one, which shows that as the inventory of the fighter forces was going down, the cost of sustaining the fleet was going up rather dramatically. And this is the second sort of point of attack for the F-35 was, can we, in fact, drive down the cost of owning and operating multi-role aircraft across not just the U.S. and the three services, but also across the coalition fleet. The third one was, once you decide that it's time to make an investment, it usually requires a pretty big investment, and we can go a certain distance where we're modernizing the previous generation airplanes, and then at some point, due to a combination of age, combination of how you measure your cost, life cycle cost, combination of growth and threat systems, there's a point at which you want to invest in the next generation of technology. And so it doesn't happen very often because it's such a major investment. Each of the participating countries participated in that investment to some extent. The only real, what we call level one partner at the time was the UK, contributing about $2 billion US to the development program, and the bulk of the Italy and the Netherlands, both about half that at about $1 billion, and the other countries at about 150 to 175 million. The last factor that comes into play is when you start planning a program like this, it's going to go for a long time. Today, our production estimate goes out to 2039, and our sustainment estimate goes out to like 2075, something like that. So when you see these big numbers that are being bantied around this program, they're very much forward-looking for a long period of time. When you have that potential for a long, sustained production, then you have to look at what's actually happening to the existing production lines that are in place, building the airplanes that we're actually replacing. And you sort of have to make a decision on, do I look forward and join a program that's more or less starting up with a planned upgrade path, or do we look at the current generation, which is clearly in the decline? If we look at that, then the program was conceived by sort of the visionaries back in the 2000-2001 timeframe as having a couple of distinct elements that determined its value proposition. The first one was that if the partner nations did decide to join the project, then there would be a ready-made coalition in the future when it was time to man up in flight as a joint service coalition type operation. If you look backwards, the last 20 years or so, that is the only type of operation we've had offshore. We haven't had any single service, we haven't had any single nation conflicts going backwards, and so going forward, we expect to maintain that same model. This weapon system was designed to allow that to happen on a much grander scale. If you have that many participants, you have the potential to capture economies of scale, which is something that's pretty elusive in our industry. A high-rate production program, F-22, was 22 airplanes a year. Super Hornet, I think, is 48 a year. F-16 today is 13 a year. So we don't have large quantities going through these factories that have been recapitalized. With the number of nations that we're talking about in F-35, we have the potential to go to another order of magnitude in terms of volume, which allows us in the long run to drive the cost of the airplane down substantially. In the upper left, you see the current threats. Obviously, they're not static. Sometimes the discussion centers on air-to-air. This is not really where the issue is today. The issue is really the proliferation of surface-to-air type systems in many places of the world. We're not talking about a peer-to-peer type of a requirement these days. We're talking about the ability to hold a strategic target at risk that's being defended by an integrated air defense system, and there's quite a few of those around the world. And then if we can capture the global nature of the program, leverage economies of scale, leverage the economies that come with some commonality across the airplanes, we have the potential to really drive down the life cycle cost of the platform. Underpinning it all, as I mentioned, is the economic dimension, which is the industrial cooperation that comes along with being part of the project. I'll talk more about that specifically later. So with that as a background, I want to orient this speech maybe a little differently than one that you've heard in the past. So what I really want to talk about today is how we can look at this program through a couple of other filters. You can look at it through the filter of an archipelago, a term that you're familiar with down here, but many people aren't. You can look at it through the prism of an ecosystem, and I sort of apply that model to the supply chain that's developing right now. And you always have to look at it through the prism of humans, because this is a human adventure for all the good and challenging parts of that. So what do I mean by those definitions? If you look at the ecosystem, this is the Webster's definition of it. In reality, I sort of look at it as nations with like-minded security interests. And that forms a common bond across the nations that are participating. That's the archipelago. If you look at the ecosystem, again, that's a system of members who benefit from each other in a symbiotic way, whether it's first-tier suppliers developing assemblies, whether it's lower-tier suppliers providing components. Then, of course, probably one of the more challenging pieces is the human part, because these programs are, as everybody knows that's on them, are very fast-paced, hard-driven, and we have a challenge just keeping the human piece of it going. Very high-level agreements that were put in place. They're fairly comprehensive. The only part that we actually were part of drafting and developing was the industrial participation and how we would do that. But those are all the countries that came on as part of the partnership. About a year later, in February 2003, two other countries joined the project from a monitoring status. These are not partners in that they don't have industrial participation. They get periodic updates and briefings on the program. And at the point in time where they're ready to move, then they notify the U.S. and they basically come in through the normal foreign military sales channel, something that the partners don't do. For every international country that comes on outside of the partnership, each of the partners gets some repayment of their investment on the development part of the program through a recruitment process. So that's the baseline project. Now, since then, you probably have read that Japan has joined the project in December of 2011, and there are other countries that are expressing interest at the current time. We're actually competing in the Republic of Korea, and there's other interest going on also.